President Trump announces his list of picks to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, including two names from Florida and Georgia. Just ahead, a closer look at the future of the high court, as issues from abortion rights to even Florida's water are now all on the line. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for listening to First Coast Connect this morning. And just ahead, from the Trump travel ban to government unions, the Florida-Georgia water war, abortion, so much is at stake now after major rulings by the Supreme Court. And what could change with the Kennedy retirement? We want your thoughts about all of it right now as we talk about the Supreme Court this morning. Give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, UF Health Jacksonville could be getting a much-needed facelift. We'll tell you what's in those plans and how they actually extend far beyond the hospital campus. Plus, a look at the Middle Passage and Port Markers Project right here in Florida, honoring those brought from Africa to the U.S. as slaves. Something you might not have heard about. We've got an update. That's all coming up, but first this morning, the high-stakes battle for the future of the Supreme Court. The fight over President Trump's plans to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy, the court's crucial swing vote, with a conservative, has become a rallying cry for base voters of both parties going into this fall's midterm elections. Now, the already ferocious nomination battle is likely to clarify choices for voters in Senate races across the country, including Florida's own Senate race. For Democrats, no less than the future of abortion rights, health care, collective bargaining, and same-sex equality is now in peril. Republicans see an opportunity to shift the high court solidly to the right for a generation or more. Now, at the same time, the court issued a series of important rulings this week. They upheld President Trump's travel ban from five majority Muslim countries. They even ruled on this Florida-Georgia fight over water. We'll talk about that, too. The Supreme Court and the future of the country tops the hour this morning as we welcome Basma Alawi. She's with the Florida Immigrant Coalition. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Also with us, Adrienne Wilmoth-Lerner, JD. She's a director and pre-law instructor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Florida. Professor Lerner, good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
And we want your calls right now as we talk all things SCOTUS on the show, whether it's abortion rights, the travel ban, unions. Even if you have questions about this fight over Florida and Georgia's water, the court ruled on that, too, this week. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Send your tweets to @MelissaInJax. And give us a call, or rather, I should say, let us know your thoughts on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Dr. Lerner, let's begin with you. President Trump is out with a list of replacements he'd like to see nominated, including Keith Blackwell of the Supreme Court of Georgia and Charles Kennedy of Florida's Supreme Court. So two regional names in the mix as the Senate looks to take up a replacement for retiring Justice Kennedy. Democrats are insisting that the seat be held open until after the midterm elections. Republicans have a slim majority, though, and are very unlikely to honor that request. And so as all of that plays out, let's begin with the issue of abortion. Your thoughts about the future of Roe versus Wade, depending on who is confirmed to the high court?
The general consensus, I think, among watchers of the court is that the Roberts Court is very incrementalist. And so a necessary, an overturn, an explicit overturn of Roe versus Wade is unlikely. But what we are likely to see are cases where the court will rule on these kind of incremental regulations on abortion. So things like parental consent or disclosures that certain medical practices have to have, whether doctors can opt out of prescribing certain abortificants, or even the location of clinics and whether areas and states can highly regulate clinics to the point where it would force many of them to close. So I think those kind of incremental cases are what you're more likely to see in abortion rights challenges.
So you think some of the rhetoric we've heard over the last 12 hours is overblown, that Roe versus Wade will survive?
Everybody wants to rally their base. So in the same way that Republicans are going to rally their base by saying, hey, we can move the court to the right for, you know, a generation by appointing a 50 your old justice, and that's a solid conservative. I think you get the same base rallying on the Democratic side, where you say all of these gains that we've made, especially in terms of women's rights and civil rights and LGBT rights, and especially in the latter, where Kennedy was so instrumental in some of those decisions and was the swing vote, that you're getting that rhetoric on both sides.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Basma Alawi, you're with the Florida Immigrant Coalition. Now, as the nomination fight over Justice Kennedy's seat will certainly be a battle royale. At the same time, the court, as it always does in June, came out with a bunch of rulings, including upholding President Trump's travel ban from five Muslim-majority countries. Your thoughts?
Yes, so allowing the Muslim ban to move forward reinforced the Trump administration's anti-family policies already. This administration is using its authority to take immigrants away from their loved ones with community ICE raids, take children from their parents at the border, and reducing the number of refugees allowed to the U.S. and appointing the anti-immigrants Ronald Mornstein to the State Department of Bureau Population, Refugees, and Migrant, and now banning people entirely from entering the United States based on their religion.
And the countries are Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and I'll have to look up the other two. Forgive me, I didn't put that in my script.
Yes.
So the court upheld the ban with a legal rationale that the president has the authority to make such sweeping rules. At the same time, even those who voted in favor of the ban criticized the president's language and rhetoric around the reasoning behind the ban. Opponents see it as discrimination against those of a different faith. Supporters see it as bolstering national security, although it's important to note Saudi Arabia is not on the ban. And of course, the 9/11 hijackers largely came from that country.
Well, I am a Muslim, and I feel I am discriminated now because it's a Muslim ban. And it's if we talk about national security, United States is one of the higher or the best of vetting people entering United States. And if I want to mention something happened with me, I came 6 years ago because of my husband's work. And we, even though he was supporting the American companies there, we went through really long vetting.
And remind listeners what country you came here from.
I came from Baghdad, Iraq.
Okay.
And after 2 years, I was expecting my child, and I was trying to bring my mom with a visitor visa. She was denied, even though she was meeting all the requirements. So it's been really hard to bring Muslims into here, even with a visitor visa. And now with this ban, people lost all their hope.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment on the travel ban upheld by the Supreme Court and the fight over Justice Kennedy's replacement on the High Court, as so many issues are now on the line, including, and the number to join us is 549-2937, including Professor Lerner, Florida's water. On Wednesday, the High Court handed this state an unlikely victory in this, I guess it's been a decades-long fight with Georgia over water rights. They ruled that a court-appointed special master was too strict in determining that no remedy in the court's power would boost water flow into the Apalachicola River and help that area's struggling oyster industry. That's sort of west of us here in Jacksonville. But this 5-4 decision remands the case, it's called Florida versus Georgia, back to a special master. What about that?
So it is a 30-year war. And Florida,
30 years.
And Florida's making a big ask here, and that's that Georgia stop draining the Chattahoochee River, and where it meets the Flint River especially is where it affects Florida. And kind of wants to cap the water use of Atlanta at 1992 levels. Well, if you've driven through Atlanta recently, you know that Atlanta is a lot bigger now than it was in 1992. So Florida's had a big ask here. But this remand does give Florida another shot at this case, and that is helpful. The special master found that, did apply a strict standard to Florida, and found that the court probably couldn't grant a remedy because he based that findings on the fact that the Corps of Engineers controls much of that water flow. And their actions had such a significant impact on water flow that even if Florida got the water reductions that it wanted out of Florida, that it perhaps wouldn't yield more water to Florida. So we're going to go back and we're going to look at that issue again and see if perhaps on a lesser standard that Florida might be able to prevail in that case.
It's been an education for people watching the high court with all this fresh attention that they can remand, they can send it back down, which isn't always clear to people who don't follow this process closely. But do you see these water wars between the two states continuing to fester?
I think as growth increases, especially at the northern end of the Chattahoochee, and certainly it's going to become a problem. Alabama didn't join the case, but has been very friendly to Florida's cause and has been very explicit in its support for Florida prevailing in this case. And you see these water wars out west. I think what's interesting about Florida, Georgia, is this is the first time we've had the Supreme Court weigh in on the southeast.
The first time in terms of this issue?
In terms of a water war similar to what we see in, say, the Colorado River Basin out west.
Right. And we'll go to your calls in just a moment as we talk about the future of the country, Florida, and the Supreme Court at 549-2937. And lots of emails and social media comments coming into the show. Andy emails the show, Canada is an increasingly viable option for my retirement. If Social Security survives, I never thought I would be considering such a thing in the country of my birth. And so for progressives, you're hearing a lot of this discussion. Basma, people are legitimately, I think, afraid of where the country is going if they fall on the progressive side, whether it comes to these steep reductions in immigration and travel, whether or not Roe versus Wade might be overturned, and a slew of other issues. And it speaks to the divide and the extreme polarization in this country that you hear people who don't support President Trump talking about leaving the country. And that's the sort of chatter we've heard off and on for years, but it's louder now.
Yes, actually, if we are looking for a safe environment, we need to make everyone feel welcome. We need to make everyone feel belong, because that's the only way to see safety around. And we are now not seeing it that much. We are being attacked as Muslim, as Hispanic communities, as all the minorities. And I think it's time for people to step up and help. I'm asking people to get out and be work together, vote, try to talk to the legislative. I'm asking our legislative too. Don't wait until the election. Now step up and support the Muslim communities and the Hispanic communities and people on the borders, because we need you now.
There will be actually a march, I think, in the city tomorrow regarding the crisis at the border, March for Children, and some events happening this weekend. And here's an email from Fabrizio. It's a shame to see Justice Kennedy go. He was the only real centrist justice left on the bench. You're shaking your head, Dr. Lerner. Kennedy held the court in a delicate balance, and his retirement will work to further polarize SCOTUS. Do you agree? Disagree? Constitutional law expert?
Uh-huh. As a court watcher, I mean, I think what most people don't know is that the court agrees with each other in 9-0 decisions 90% of the time. What we see, and especially what we see in June decisions, are these very polarizing issues, are the things that the Supreme Court had to give the most thought to that have the most social and political weight. And these tend to be the 5-4 decisions that drop right now. And Kennedy has been instrumental in those. Now, make no mistake about it, Kennedy is a conservative justice. There are just a few social, especially flashpoint issues that Kennedy has been more liberal on. And so I think that he gets this credit of being perhaps more centrist than his voting record shows because of landmark cases.
All right, let's go to some calls now at 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about the Supreme Court this morning. And by the way, a Florida name is on the list of candidates to replace Justice Kennedy. It's Charles Kennedy of the Florida Supreme Court. He was appointed by former Governor Charlie Crist. Okay, let's go to Donald in St. Augustine. Hi, Donald. Good morning.
Good morning. This is a, of course, a complex issue as always with everything. And being a conservative, I'm quite happy about this. and have a totally different viewpoint than yourself, than many people there, your callers. But I do want to say that the caller who just recently talked about going to Canada, back during the 8 years of the Obama administration, I was looking for another country to go to, but I could not find one that has as great of a constitution as ours. So I, just put up with it.
Yeah, and but so anyway, you were thinking about, let me just ask you, Donald, so you wanted to leave the country because you were unhappy with the direction of the country under Obama. Where were you thinking of going?
Well, the sad part is there's really nowhere to go that, as I look, that is not socialist. I love Europe, but except for Eastern Europe, would have been a possibility. But there's no other country in this world that has a great of a constitution as and Bill of Rights as we do, and protection of the law most of the time for everybody. So anyway, so like I said, everybody's got different viewpoints, and I'm strong on mine, and it should be interesting. And for anybody who wants to leave the country because of this, Delta is ready when you are.
Thanks for the call, Basma Alawi.
I think no one should leave the country. We are here to stay. We are here to fight back these bills that can affect everyone here. I don't think anyone, as a parent I'm talking, would like to see kids being separated from their families. So I don't think anyone will leave. We are here because we believe in the people in here. We believe in this country and the Constitution. And we will come out and vote and help each other to bring families together.
Dr. Lerner.
I mean, I would say, especially when we're talking about the Supreme Court itself, that any of the potential justices appointed are people who love the Constitution and have dedicated their careers to it. That doesn't mean that we don't have significant disagreements about jurisprudence and about these social issues that the court will face. But some of the rhetoric that gets tossed out there about certain judges not upholding the Constitution or not loving the Constitution or not being good constitutional guardians, I think as a court watcher and a professor, really is one of those things I try to correct in my students frequently.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Lisa. I have hope, but have slowly become disappointed and disgusted with our system of checks and balances. The past few years to me have been showing our government to be moving away from what's written in our Constitution. I am concerned that SCOTUS will be moving further away from being a part of the check and balance system. That to me is very scary.
I think it's still an important check and balance system, and I think that system overall works. I mean, the thing we say as political science instructors is that our institutions are strong and will always be strong and will save us. I think that if you look at the travel ban case, if you look at Trump v. Hawaii, that we do see that the court is saying, okay, well, in this instance, wide, broad executive power was just fine. We've had some other cases that haven't been as high profile this year where the court has been less trusting of the administration to enforce certain laws. So it's still there. It takes a little digging and nuance into the cases.
Let's go to Jimmy. He's downtown. Hi, Jimmy. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So I'm a court watcher, especially from the perspective of LGBT rights. And, having Justice Kennedy, who's authored all four major LGBT rights decisions of the court, going back to Lawrence v. Texas and then through the marriage cases, having him depart the court is concerning. But it's sort of a push because he also joined the court on the Citizens United decision and on the Hobby Lobby decision and notoriously on Bush v. Gore. So it's an important moment to see which direction the court goes, because this gentleman has been the center of the court for 30 years.
Right. And thank you for that and pointing that out. And by the way, we're getting a lot of tweets and emails about how this all played out. Here's one from Brian. The blocking of Obama nominee Merrick Garland was bad precedent. If you want a law that the president can't nominate a justice in the last 6 months or last year of his term, make it a law. Adam tweets, Mitch McConnell set the precedent with Merrick Garland and Neil Gorsuch. There should be no new justice until the midterm elections are over. What about that, Dr. Lerner?
That's certainly going to be a fight on the Democratic base. I mean, you have a lot of left-leaning voters in this country that are upset about the Merrick Garland position and about the denial of that Supreme Court seat. And I think you're going to find that same rhetoric that was used about denying Obama's appointee a fair up and down vote, that I think you're going to see a lot of that resurface in a way. It's interesting now that the change in procedure from the supermajority vote to the majority vote might make it easier if we have a flip of the Senate in midterms to continually deny Trump's nominees.
The heat on the Democratic senators is going to be intense, but there really aren't, there isn't much they can do procedurally to stop the president and Senate Majority Leader McConnell from confirming the president's choice, unless they can flip a couple of Republican senators their way, particularly over this issue of Roe versus Wade. For example, Senator Murkowski of Alaska, Senator Collins of Maine, both women, the heat on those two female senators is going to be extraordinary.
And I think you've also had some Republican members of the Senate who have gone against Trump and are towing a more moderate line that perhaps will also be targets for any kind of extreme right nominees.
Let's go to Scott in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, Scott. Good morning. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just had a question kind of towards what Donald was saying before about wanting to leave the country during the Obama years. My question towards him would be, what did Obama do that caused you to want to leave? Because there's a lot of people nowadays that, because, you know, women have more rights, minorities have more rights, LGBT people have more rights. I mean, is that the reason that you wanted to leave during the Obama years? Because that's what worries me right now, is that we seem to be moving further and further away from that with what the Trump administration is doing, and especially with Justice Kennedy retiring. Now, who knows what's going to happen with any decisions that would have been made with the Supreme Court when Obama was in office.
Right. And I appreciate your call, Scott. So we're getting a range of opinions from callers this morning, Basma. I think for conservatives, the Obama years were very difficult on a range of issues. I think they had fears about gun rights. That's a big one. Those didn't really come to fruition. But there were certainly a lot of fears among conservatives about their values being trampled, their identity being marginalized, or certainly that's how a lot of people felt. You know, and so now hearing Scott out at the beaches talk, what we're seeing are progressives feeling that the gains that have been made the last half century or so of social progress, whether it comes to people of color, women, gay people, immigrants, people of different faiths, the fear among progressives now is that all of that is going to be rolled back with this high court pick.
Well, I appreciate what Scott said. I think what we are going through now is just, I see division, and I hope this will stop, because what's happened in Iraq in after 2003, I feel like it started happening here. We are seeing people who is getting out of the circle and just saying, "Oh, I don't belong to this circle. These are not my kids who they are on the borders. I am not Muslim. I am not from these countries. I'm calling even the Muslims people who are not from these countries. I'm from Iraq, but I have friends from Syria and Somalia and Libya and Yemen, and I am standing here for them. So I'm calling people who of faith, Muslims and Christian. If you say I'm Christian, God said, love your neighbors. I am your neighbors. And if you are saying you're Muslim, but you are not belong to one of these countries, you need to step up to these people. We need to love others the way we love ourselves and not be selfish.
Thanks for that. And thanks so much to Basma Alawi of the Florida Immigrant Coalition, Dr. Adrienne Lerner of UNF's Political Science Department. Ladies, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, on tomorrow's show, we'll be talking about a series of events happening around the First Coast Friday and over the weekend, particularly marches for children having to do with the crisis at the border and families separated from their parents. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to record a voice memo with your thoughts about that crisis and email it to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We're going to play some of those comments on tomorrow's show. Still ahead, remembering those sold into slavery and the trips they were forced to make across the Atlantic, how that's being memorialized right here in our area. But up next, some good news. Long-awaited building improvements coming to UF Health Jacks and the surrounding neighborhood. We'll tell you about it in a moment.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
He was 39 and I was 15. He was black, I was brown. And he was a convicted cop killer. I was the president of Chess Club.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This week, stories about self-defense, sled dogs, and death row. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, earlier this week, Mayor Curry's Budget Review Committee unveiled a list of dozens of capital improvement projects his administration wants to fund for the next fiscal year. Now, these projects would add up to about $189 million in the city budget, and they include improvements to things like the McCoy's Creek portion of that long-awaited emerald necklace around the urban core. There's also money to demolish part of the Hart Bridge ramps right by the Jaguar Stadium. And included in the projects are some long-awaited building renovations on the campus of UF Health Jacksonville on 8th Street. Here now with more about that, we welcome by phone Dr. Leon Haley Jr. He's CEO of UF Health Jacksonville. Dr. Haley, good to talk to you.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well, thanks. So what is in the budget for UF Health Jacksonville? Tell us about it.
So we had approached the mayor's office about a year ago saying that the institution was starting to show its age. The hospital is a little over 40 years old. Our ambulatory care building is a little over 30 years old. And we thought we would approach them about working together to support some infrastructure needs. So really what's in there, Melissa, is nothing fancy. It's really around trying to make sure that the roof is appropriate, that our fire alarm system is where it needs to be, our electrical system, things that would be the common upgrades that sometimes for us with our budget can be a challenge. But that's how we approached, and we're really thankful for the mayor's office for potentially putting that in the budget.
Sure. Now, UF Health Jacksonville has an incredible research arm. It has the Proton Beam, Proton Therapy Institute for Cancer Treatment. It also has Trauma One, this area's only level one trauma center, which is so important. And it's this area's safety net hospital for people that have nowhere else to be treated. Over the years, off and on, the former Shands, as many people still call it, now UF Health Jacks, has really struggled to make ends meet. And so I think that it's vitally important everybody understand what a disaster it would be for medical care in this community if UF Health weren't around. Can you tell us a little bit about where you are financially right now, just in general? Because I know that there have been problems in the past, particularly before you arrived here on the scene.
Certainly. I think overall we have a very thin margin. We will end in the black this year, but just above zero, quite honestly. We have taken a couple of challenges this year. Number one, the hurricane certainly hurt us because it came in on a Sunday, which meant the hospital volumes and many of our clinics were closed on Monday and Tuesday. We took an unexpected $4 million hit from the federal government as it relates to a program called 340B pricing. And then, as you know, in the state budget for FY18, which came out last year, there was a $22 million hit. Thanks to the efficiency of our team and making sure we continue to provide clinical care, all the things that you describe, level one trauma center being the safety net, and obviously seeing a good patient payer mix at our North campus, we're going to do okay. But the problem with the okay is it's not enough to invest very strongly back into the infrastructure, which is why we want to partner with the city to make sure that our infrastructure can meet all the needs of the community.
And we're talking right now with Dr. Leon Haley, Jr., CEO of UF Health Jacksonville. UF Health is going to get a windfall as the city looks at its largest capital improvement program in years. Lots of infrastructure spending, street paving, sidewalk construction, tearing down some of those Hart Bridge ramps. Lots happening with this. Let me ask you at the same time, Dr. Haley, of course, Florida as yet has yet to expand Medicaid to low-income patients. And so I would like to get your future thoughts about how that affects hospitals like UF Health and any advocacy you plan about that issue with the state legislature going forward.
Well, certainly for us, like many institutions across the state, and we're seeing sort of the slight increase in our uninsured population as what we're seeing nationally. So as the ACA continues to unravel a little bit, there we are seeing more people who are uninsured, and there's no gap in the Medicaid funding to support that. So we are going to work very closely with our legislative team to work with the state, to work with the city, to think about, you know, how can we provide the proper insurance for patients who need coverage. So it will be an active part of our legislative process, both at the state level, probably a little bit federally. We are working with one of our national organizations on the 340B pricing model, as I talked about earlier, and obviously working with the city. So we're trying to partner with everybody so that we can continue to provide the care that the community needs.
Thanks so much for joining us. He's Dr. Leon Haley, Jr., CEO of UF Health Jacksonville. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation.
Still to come, the latest on this area's Middle Passage ceremonies and Port Markers Project, marking those who made the Middle Passage to this country into slavery. We'll tell you about it. Keep listening.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, a lot of the terms used in social psychology are misleading at best and sometimes just plain wrong. For instance?
So one that comes to mind is bystander apathy.
So what are psychologists good for anyway?
That's not a bad question, actually.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Sunday at 1 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, a live call-in program where you talk about the biggest stories in the state.
This Friday, new pressure on South Florida facilities housing migrant children as a judge rules they must be reunited with their parents. Also, why Florida is getting a cryptocurrency czar.
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Next time on Jazz Night in America, East meets West, and the West meets the East. Tabla master Zakir Hussain and bass legend Dave Holland share with us Cross Currents, a world of ideas flowing between India and America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a movement to remember the 12 million Africans who were sold into slavery on ships known as the Middle Passage. About 2 million people didn't survive that horrible trip across the Atlantic. The Middle Passage Ceremonies and the Port Markers Project seeks to document all 50 Middle Passage port sites here in the U.S. and put up markers to tell the story of the slave trade. There were five ports in Florida that were part of the Middle Passage, including Amelia Island and St. Augustine. Here with more, we're pleased to welcome back to the show Ann Chin. She's the leader of the Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Markers Project. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And if you have questions about this, give us a call at 549-2937. And you have some news about this. What is it?
Yeah, I'm glad to be back on the show. We were informed in March that each one of the identified documented sites will be included in the United Nations UNESCO Slave Trade Route Project. They will be identified, designated as sites of memory. We've been lobbying for this designation for the past 6 years.
Long time coming then.
Yes, yes. And as the numbers of identified sites has grown so that it ranges from Maine to Texas, Florida is one of the states that has the most arrival ports. It has five. And the only site right now in Florida, Amelia Island, that is not in an active planning stage for the marker. Pensacola folded in recently, and so they're going to put their marker in downtown. St. Augustine's is at the Mission Nombre de Dios.
Right there north of the historic district.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Key West has theirs at the cemetery right at the tip of this, where the post says 90 miles from Cuba. We also have Mosquito Inlet, New Smyrna, and that history is really unique because it combines the history of the Greeks and the Minorcans who came and worked at the Turnbull plantation. There were 50 Africans who also were enslaved there.
What do these markers look like if you come upon one? And they're near the ocean or right on the ocean, aren't they?
Well, most of them are. We just encourage locales to put up the markers. So they are different designs. The text reflects the local history. New Orleans just put theirs up, and they're going to have their unveiling July 7th. And they have two, one for the domestic trade and one for the international trade. None of them look exactly the same except those that were put up by the National Park Service. Those are more uniform. But I actually like the idea that every section or every site determines the text and the design of the marker.
And as you pointed out, there are five documented Middle Passage arrival sites in Florida: Key West, St. Augustine, New Smyrna, Amelia Island, and Pensacola. Everyone but Amelia Island has a marker up or is in the process. Why not Amelia yet?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I can't answer for the site. We certainly have been lobbying, and the Amelia Museum of History, it's the Amelia Island Museum of History, has been working with us. They've had a ceremony, a remembrance ceremony, but so far, no marker.
Okay. And so for people that might have a little bit of trouble getting their heads around this, describe what happened at these ports of entry for people who were captured, shackled, put on Middle Passage ships, and then brought to our shores.
Well, I mean, every site is unique in terms of its history, so that you have different codes of behavior for enslavement, whether it's Spanish or Dutch or British or French colony. So those things are unique. But what was common and shared is the fact that these people were removed from their homes, their society, their culture. I call it a near death, that 25% of those who arrived were children. So that I think it's important that as we deal with our present issues in immigration and removal of children from their families, that we understand that this has been a practice in this society and this culture from the beginning. These things that we are looking at, the violence, the terror, all of these are part and parcel of a history and a culture that justified and legalized enslavement.
Not only that, this project honors the fact that about 2 million people didn't survive the trip.
Yes.
Because the conditions were so horrific,
well,
right?
Yes, yeah. Some died from sickness, dehydration, violence, and then a large portion of people simply committed suicide in the sense that they opted to end the horror by jumping into the ocean.
They jumped overboard, and we don't know how many, right?
No.
We don't know how many.
No, we wouldn't know.
You know, it's amazing what a capacity we have for denial in this country about the fact that this nation was quite literally founded on the backs of slavery of African Americans and genocide of Native Americans. But it's simply the truth.
Yes.
And these markers go a small way toward at least raising awareness about that. And it's been a long, difficult project, as you said, from Maine all the way to Texas to get this project going. What's the length of the history of this project?
Well, by sight, it takes normally between 12 to 18 months. And it involves certainly community organizing, meeting with people, describing what has occurred in their location, and then encouraging them to consider that this is an important step in healing, in addressing the history. And as you said, there's a real tradition in this country of denial, of an inability to tell the truth, historically. And the history that's normally told to our children is one of European conquest and domination. So that to include other people, Native Americans, Africans, Latinos, that's what we're pushing for, that we are opening the door to tell a broader history and also to understand what we're experiencing today. Because I don't think if you look at this in isolation, if you look at today in isolation, you don't really understand what is happening.
How so?
In terms of the violence, the terror, the removal of children from their families. I mean, this happened with Africans. It happened also with Native children, the Native schools where children were removed and then encouraged to basically, quote, become Americans.
We'll continue talking about this with Ann Chin of the Port Markers Project in just a moment here on the show. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
is your American Graduate Champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is September 1st, 2018. Go to WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
It's been a busy term for the Supreme Court. Now the fight over a new justice begins.
We will begin our search for a new justice of the United States Supreme Court that will begin immediately.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A wrap of Supreme Court decisions and what lies ahead this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
This is what the country hears.
You watch how horrible. They're coming in from Honduras. They're coming in from other places. They're taking this long trek up Mexico.
But what do the numbers say about people arriving at the border? A look at why people are really crossing and where they're coming from. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Facebook says it's not its job to decide what's true and what's not, but its leaders are doing more to fight hate speech. But how do you do that with 2 billion users, the vast majority of whom are outside the United States? We'll meet the Facebook exec who's taking on the world next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Ann Chin, the national leader of the Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Markers Project. For years now, Ann, working from her base here in Northeast Florida, has been crisscrossing the country, working with 19 states total, from Maine all the way to Texas, to install markers at ports of entry for the notorious Middle Passage, which marked hundreds of years of the slave trade. And so when you go to these markers now, you can learn more about the Middle Passage and what happened to Africans when they were brought to this country as slaves. 19 states, that's a lot of phone calls and a lot of driving.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that there's an internet.
I bet you are.
I couldn't have managed without that.
Is this something that you just thought up one day and you just started the work to make it happen?
No, originally it was a present, a birthday gift given to me by a friend of Toni Morrison's who said that she had been haunted by the fact that we as a people, African descent, and then as a nation, did not acknowledge the history and certainly did not remember or in any way address memorializing those who had died in the Middle Passage. It certainly has grown since then to also address those who survived the Middle Passage. And I will say that this project only identifies those port sites where people came directly from Africa. So that limits sort of the focus. But the fact that no matter where you are in the Americas or Europe, if your people came here, you know, certainly before the 20th century, they shared the Middle Passage. That is a shared history that all of us have in the Americas.
And in order to educate people, you are also working on some curriculum for elementary and middle school students. How is that going?
Well, that's sort of our newest leg, and it really is exciting. There are 2 particular events or initiatives. One is actually being promoted in Boulder, Colorado, where Peter Wood, who is a historian and expert on Charleston, South Carolina, is now, he's retired and he's now in Colorado, and he's working with 4th and 5th graders And what the children do is to study the Atlantic slave trade, human trade, and that hopefully, or at least the intent of that project, is to create empathy, because that's one of the things that we need to encourage among our young people, is that they see a connection. And so they each child takes on the persona of a child who is caught in the human trade, and they do one paragraph or one page of their experiences, and they have put together books. There's been some resistance to it because they're saying, oh, these kids are too young to know this horror, but they're not. Their interpretation of the experience has been just mind-boggling, and they have books that they have produced. It's now in their second year. The other thing that we're doing is particular here to Florida is a program called I Am the Dream of My Ancestors. And we are encouraging organizations and groups to have a group of middle school children basically do their family history, do family interviews, and then they map out, particularly the U.S., the history of their family and where they've been. It's been mind-boggling, that. And then whoever survives all of that work, which is about 2 months, their names are put in a hat, and one child's name is drawn, and with the parents' permission, they do a DNA test. And then they look at themselves globally, because none of this history, none of the politics, nothing makes sense unless you can connect it personally.
That's right. And yeah. What a beautiful way to do it. Well, I encourage everyone to go to middlepassageproject.org to learn more about the incredible work of Jacksonville's own Ann Chin, who leads this effort nationally. Ann, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you, Melissa.
That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. Our theme is composed by the symphony's Pyotr Shevchuk. Make sure to join us at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday roundtable. We're going to be talking about marches for children taking place around town this weekend to protest the crisis at the border. We want you to use your voice memo function on your phone to record your thoughts about that and email us the audio to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We'll air some of those responses tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. 1A is up next. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. Thanks, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.